Welcome to today's IT Showcase webinar. I'm Jim Adams, a technologist and business program manager with IT Showcase. Today we'll be talking with IT service engineer and IT expert Chad Morris, who will be talking about enhancing security and reliability with Exchange Online Protection. But before I ask Chad to introduce himself, I'd like to remind everyone online that you can use the tools in your window to ask us any questions during this broadcast that you might have, and also to answer the poll questions so that we can better focus our discussion on what you'd like to hear. So Chad, please take a moment to introduce yourself, and let's get going with your content.
All right, thanks, Jim.
You bet.
My name is Chad Morris. I'm an IT service engineer here within Microsoft IT. I've been with the company for about 13 years, primarily focused on our Exchange service, and now Office 365 all up. So let's dive into the content. What we're going to be talking to you guys about today, we're going to give you a brief introduction of what Exchange Online Protection does for us. We're going to be talking about blocking threats at the connection level, blocking threats at the content level, blocking threats at the user level, and then just some miscellaneous other blocks and protection that we have with Exchange Online Protection.
Yeah. Chad, how much of your presentation today applies to Exchange Online versus Exchange on-premises?
Well, what we're going to be talking about today applies to both.
Excellent.
Our Exchange on-premises, you know, personally, if you set up in a hybrid setup, kind of like we are, mm-hmm. You can have Exchange Online Protection route all your email and deliver it to your on-premises organization. We personally have Exchange Online mailboxes, but you don't need to migrate any data there.
Okay, so you don't have to have the mailboxes in the cloud in order to use Exchange Online.
Nope, you just need an Office 365 license for Exchange Online Protection and a hybrid setup.
Excellent, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. All right, let's dive in. So Exchange Online Protection, or EOP as we're going to call it from here on out, is a cloud-based email filtering service that's part of Office 365. EOP blocks threats at different levels, some of which can be configured using a web-based management tool. That's where we're talking connections, content, blocked senders, invalid recipients, and you know, not only blocking but also allowing and overriding any block rules that the service or you may have. Microsoft IT, personally, we monitor the ever-changing landscape of external threats. And we use EOP to monitor and block these threats at the connection, content, and user levels. And we're going to go through here and talk about each of those levels now. So if we're going to be talking about blocking threats at the connection level, EOP first scans your protocol at the connection level against its list of known malicious IP addresses.
How long is that list?
The list is quite extensive. There's a lot of malicious senders and services out there that wish to send you email.
I can imagine.
Yeah, especially targeting larger enterprises. So if an email or connection comes from one of these IPs on the that's a known source of spam, EOP will block that email outright. Similarly, EOP also detects when a sender attempts too many connections in a short period of time. So if they're trying, a denial of service attack, EOP handles this for you, not your edge servers or hub transport servers. They don't need to deal with all those connections. EOP handles it for you and will block those IPs for a specific period of time. Temporarily, let's say. So using EOP, we in Microsoft IT manage a list of our own IP addresses that are blocked and allowed. So we have a list that we consider safe and a list that we consider unsafe. We have many different business partners, including hardware suppliers, companies that provide us services, including our employee benefits and our company store. And they send emails to users at Microsoft from external. And some of these are like newsletter updates, things with unsubscribe links in them, image links to remote sites. And so they are, they're spam-like or spam-looking emails, and we have to allow them into our senders or our recipients just because it's business-critical email. So we will manage our own IP allow list. We don't want to filter mail out from these partners, and that's why we have to manage them. All right. So let's talk about a content level. EOP lets us get pretty granular with filtering mail at a content level. We use the different EOP features to apply spam filtering that comply with our own company security policies. So to do this accurately, we performed a business analysis with our corporate security team in information risk management. And then we adjusted the EOP spam filtering rules accordingly. The level of spam filtering will differ for each business or each enterprise, so I suggest doing a business analysis.
Can users contribute to this list if they if a message does get through and they think that it needs to be on the list so that others don't get it? Can they contribute to this list by providing feedback to the service?
They absolutely can. Exchange okay. Online Protection allows you to submit mails that made it through the filter that you believe are junk, mm-hmm. as well as they let you submit false positives where a mail was filtered as junk but probably shouldn't have been. So you can provide that feedback through the, to the service through, if you're using Outlook, through a plugin, or to the service just through an email reply where you send the email as an attachment to them.
So the false positives, how does the user know that it should have come through if they never saw it?
Ah, good point. That's where the business analysis comes
okay.
in. So we as Microsoft determined right at the beginning that we weren't going, if we were going to block an email, and when I say block, I say move to your junk email folder in
okay.
Outlook.
Okay.
That's the process we were going to take. There are a lot of enterprises out there that don't want their users to see any of the spam.
Gotcha.
So they will reject it or quarantine it somewhere else. And EOP allows you to do that as well. But
so
we
it's
internally
fairly flexible.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So we internally at Microsoft allow users to see their junk email, and if they see that it probably shouldn't have been blocked, they can report it from there.
Okay. Because yeah. this stuff is getting really crafty now.
It really is.
Yes.
We see a lot of ever-changing, trends in the email industry mm-hmm. when it comes to spam, and it's not even not so much spam anymore. It's more of the malicious types like phishing.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So if we go back to content level filtering, within our corporate email service, like I said, we partner closely with our corporate security team, and for example, our email service team will mark messages that contain certain elements such as image links to remote sites, URL redirects, emails with particular trigger words in them, or stop words as we call it, and we mark those as spam. Of course, again, doing your business analysis, your trigger or stop words will be different from ours. The filters for potential threats can be turned on and off individually. It's very granular that way. When we identify a mail as spam, you can reject it, or you can do what we do, is we apply an X header to the email, and that X header is then read by our transport servers in Exchange Online, and then says, hey, if this email has this X header, we're going to mark it with a spam confidence level of 6, which sends the mail to the user's junk email folder. So after searching for that X header and it's present, like I said, set the spam confidence level, and in that way, a user can see the mail that we've marked as junk and either go through their junk email and delete them all or submit them as false positives if necessary. Because we are in a hybrid setup and we use Exchange Online primarily as our entry point, our authoritative service, all of that routing and transport rules happens in the cloud. And this takes any heavy routing needs away from our on-premise servers. Users can also set rules that instruct Exchange Online to move messages into folders of their choosing. Exchange Online also offers various transport rules that you can set. So with the different transport rules, for an example, you can restrict access to email content, and you can do that through EOP as well, where the email service team, such as myself and our other admins, can specifically set a rule to apply rights management to a specific message. And we have many, many transport rules that do that, again, on a business need. The businesses that use these transport rules, such as like our Xbox team when they come to to ship hardware. We make them present a business justification to us in IT, and then if we find that that business justification is just and true, then we will set up the rules for them. So now let's talk at the user level. So we've talked connection, we've talked content. Now let's talk what an actual user can do. So users can institute their own level of blocking. And this is important because many users will have different needs. Some users are going to want, I don't want any spam email. I know these people, they just always send me spam. I want it in my junk email folder. And some users don't care. Like personally, I don't get enough spam to alter with my own safe senders and block senders. But, Jim, maybe you do. The block senders list and the safe senders list, or the allowed senders list, are built into the Outlook client and the Exchange Outlook web app. Along with there's other things that you can do in there with actions to email. We in Microsoft IT lets users maintain their own lists of these types, which that means if a message is marked as spam, it will still be delivered to the user's inbox if that user is in their safe senders list. Same goes for if they're in their block senders list, it'll deliver to their junk mailbox, even if EOP doesn't think that is spam.
Is there a practical limit to the length or the size of the block list or the safe list?
In practice, no, we haven't come across that limit yet. I'm sure there is.
Okay, so if you reach the tens of thousands of items, it might slow things down a little.
What would probably happen is you wouldn't be able to add any more users to it, so you'd have to remove some.
Okay.
But we at Microsoft IT have many, many users that are using that feature, mm-hmm. and I haven't heard of anyone hitting that limit yet.
Okay.
Yeah. So the next question is, what if a user doesn't want to update their own safe senders list or block senders list? Yeah, we as an admin can do that for them in Exchange PowerShell. Using the set mailbox junk email configuration commandlet. It's a mouthful. So we can run that in PowerShell, and an admin can run it and create an entry for a particular user mailbox to allow a user to send mail to them or have it moved to their junk.
While we're talking about junk mail, there's a question here. Is there any specific reason why spam stays in quarantine only for a maximum 15 days? Might be a bit problematic during the holiday season. Which one do you prefer, junk or quarantine?
We prefer junk, just because of that. Over the holidays, or there are many companies that we work with that take the entire month of like July off, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe year end or cultural reasons. Who knows? That's why we as a company decided to move everything to your junk email folder, where it will stay in perpetuity as long as you have the space in your mailbox.
Okay.
Yeah. Make sure I covered everything here for the user level. So blocking threats at the user level, a user can do it themselves or an admin can do it for them. The safe senders and block senders lists can be very lengthy if they want to be. Like I said, we haven't hit the major limits yet. And these rules will override our junk email filtering rules that we set on the service. So if you think about the order, it'll be any allow rules will supersede block rules, and any user level rules will supersede service level rules.
Okay, so safe overrides block.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you have me in your block list and me in your allow list, emails from me will come into your inbox.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'll just have to either take you off of the send or save senders list or
block
you again.
Yeah, absolutely. You can just move it to deleted items if
sure.
you want. Yeah. All right. Fantastic. Thanks, Jim. All right. So there are some other threats that we use EOP for, and that is, and I guess it's not threats. It's other features within EOP that we utilize quite heavily. And one of those is TLS, or Transport Layer Security. So we do a lot of business contact with other external companies, as well as acquisitions. And we want to secure the communication between both parties. So we'll use EOP to set up connectors, as well as other transport rules that ensure TLS is applied to all outbound and incoming mail. Out of the box, EOP does opportunistic TLS, which is if the recipient is showing the start TLS flag on their connection server or their edge, we'll send in TLS. However, with our business partners, we want to make sure that's enforced. So if for some reason they aren't showing the TLS flag, we won't actually send mail to them. We really want to make sure that is secured, the connection.
And TLS, again, is transport layer security.
Transport layer security, yes. Also, we have directory-based edge blocking, or DBEB, D-B-E-B. It's a feature within Exchange Online and EOP that allows users to reject messages for invalid recipients at our network perimeter, at the connection level. By using DBEB, Microsoft IT can specify recipients in Office 365 and then block messages sent to addresses that aren't specified. So fake user at Microsoft wouldn't be accepted, whereas, Jim Adams at Microsoft absolutely would be.
Okay.
Yeah. And so what we do, because we're in a hybrid setup, all our users get created in our on-premise organization, are synced up to Office 365 and into EOP. And that's how the addresses get there.
Okay. While we're on that topic, we have a question here. Do you have any worries about new users not getting their mail right away when they sign up, and get their account?
Yeah. There are some times where an account is created, and because we have to go from on-premises to Office 365, there is time for it to sync there. And that time usually is between 2 and 3 hours. There is a worry if there's someone that needs to be added ASAP, mm-hmm. but in reality, our onboarding process happens well before a user is expecting any external mail, so that gives it time to sync up there.
Excellent.
Okay. Yeah, but during your design conversations and implementation conversations for EOP, it's definitely something that you need to think about.
But our users' mileage will vary depending upon their onboarding processes and all the sync that they have to go through.
Absolutely.
As well.
And if you're not using it in hybrid, if you're a cloud-only customer, it's instantaneous.
Okay.
Yeah. So we in Microsoft IT, like I said, use DBEB, and this decreases the impact on our transport servers in the cloud as well as on-premises because it doesn't have to deal with any fake email addresses. And you'd actually be surprised with how much email address harvesting goes on out there. And so that we found internally that increased the efficiency of our on-premise transport servers as well as our undeliverable traffic we saw go down 70%. Which is hundreds of thousands of emails daily for us.
Right.
Yeah. So, in summary, we use Exchange Online Protection to block messages at the content, the connection, and the user level. We have a mixture of block and allow rules. And we configure TLS and directory-based edge blocking to provide additional protection for our users, all through both the web UI as well as Exchange PowerShell. So now we have to talk best practices on how we implemented and how we work with Exchange Online Protection. So there are a number of best practices that we learned when we deployed. And we're going to discuss these over the next two slides. So first, to set up EOP, Microsoft IT, our admin team, we had to point our MX record, our mail exchanger record, to EOP. And once we did that, EOP started accepting the mail for our tenant. All email then arrives from Microsoft is delivered to EOP where it's scanned. EOP can then be managed through the Exchange Admin Center, like I said, or the remote PowerShell. And after we did that, we were able to start obtaining some detailed reports by downloading or the Excel spreadsheets that EOP provides, or using their out-of-box reporting in the web UI. And we were able to analyze actually how much spam EOP was actually filtering, as well as malware, as well as some of our top senders. So the counts that we're really concerned about and we report on a weekly basis is the amount of spam that we get, the amount of malware that we get that EOP filters out, the top senders in our company, the top recipients in our company, the top amount of spam recipients in our company, and just the amount of email going to and from Microsoft. And that's all tracked through EOP. And like I said, this information can be generated in PowerShell by running the commandlets for custom reports and or using the out-of-box reporting that EOP provides. And a byproduct of this, because we work very closely with our information security team, is they sometimes use these reports in investigations because you can filter out by specific recipient if you'd actually like to. Finally, we found that it was completely necessary for us to set up a user request fulfillment site. And so we created some forms that allow users to go in and request certain things. Adding an IP to our allow list, adding an IP to our block list, setting up TLS with a new business partner, place for our venture integration team to go and let us know about future integrations so we can set up the appropriate TLS connections as well.
What about executives and VIPs? Any special rules for them?
So we used to have special rules for them when we were on premises. But after moving to EOP in the cloud, we didn't need those anymore. Because, you know, we have our service level rules, and then the executive can get as granular as they want with their user level rules.
Okay. So the product took care of that for you.
Absolutely. And I know the question's going to come, but, you know, the executives aren't going to manage these rules on their own. We at Microsoft have an executive support team that we give access to manage these rules for our executives through an RBAC role or roles-based access control.
Okay.
So we set up this user fulfillment site. It also, you know, as users add IPs to our allow list, our block list, we keep a record, and we can go back on report and show why we have a certain IP in our allow or our block list. All right, some more best practices. So continuing along, IT has a process in place to react to phishing attacks or large volumes of spam or zero-day attacks. Users can set up, so out there you can set up a help desk process or a security escalation process. We personally have a security escalation process where the security team can escalate and respond quickly to these type of threats.
Is that one of those situations where it's, oops, I clicked that link and I shouldn't have?
This is more, hey, I got this email, and it's redirecting me to a site that's asking me for my corporate credentials.
Okay. So this is more reporting, phishing, yeah, rather than, oops, I clicked a link in this phishing email.
Yeah. Okay. So security team would care more about, like, did you actually click the link? Mm-hmm. But we internally care more about the mail that contains that link.
Okay.
So we're able to react. So we notice that these threats are slowly evolving away from spam and malware to these phishing and social engineering mails that Jim is talking about. IT pros, you know, us admins, need to be aware that of these industry trends and how they change. And in these schemes, if someone sends a message that attempts a user to persuade a user that it's from a trustable or creditable source and gets them to enter usernames or passwords or date of birth or credit card information, then we need to be able to react. And that's why it was really important for us to partner with our security team who get these escalations. Because, we ultimately taught them how to phish and gave them access to create these rules to start blocking these messages in the future. We also trained our help desk to retrieve and delete these messages from users' mailboxes if necessary. Finally, because they have their fingers actually in the service, it helps them define the appropriate policies that we can then abide by as an email service for a large enterprise. So that partnership has been very, very important. A lot of the steps that the help desk has had to take, as well as the security team has had to take, we've tried to automate it if possible. And we also have to make sure that new people who come onto these teams have the appropriate permissions to do their work. So, finally, in conclusion, over the entire amount of technical blocking and allowing that we talked about, as well as our policies and methods, it kind of leads us down the line of successful protection for an enterprise is going to be a sum of both parts. The proactive configuration and business analysis, the reactive policies and methods provided by partnering with your security teams, as well as defining an email security policy and enforcing it, is going to lead you down the road to successful protection. And that's how we found to be the most successful in protecting our enterprise. So in your announcements window, there's going to be some resources here that you can click on at your leisure. Some are white papers that we in IT have wrote for migration, as well as some of the mail protection reports I talked about earlier that will be available to you. And that's the content I have for you today.
That's great. Great. Thank you, Shad. That's good information. Before we take questions from the audience, I'd like to ask our audience to take a moment to answer our final poll question. Tell us what you think about the content that Shad presented today. And we'll get to the questions here. I wrote some down, and we have some on the monitor here. Okay, here's one for you. Can you manage DBEB from EOP in Office 365? If so, how do you access DBEB, assuming through PowerShell?
So DBEB is managed by having your, like I said, a hybrid setup. So if you have email addresses in Office 365, all email addresses, SMTP proxy addresses, are synced into DBEB. So to manage that, you'd have to manage the mail user objects in Office 365 to ensure that all the SMTP addresses that you wanted DBEB to accept are actually in Office 365. Or I know there used to be a tool, and I believe there still is, to sync your on-premise organization's SMTP addresses to DBEB. So you just need to ensure that all the addresses, SMTP addresses, that you want to accept mail for are on user objects in your organization.
Okay.
There's no actual management of DBEB through the portal. So.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, let's look here. All right. How often do you go through the IP allow block lists and reevaluate whether or not the IP should still be on that list?
Good question. So because we set up the user fulfillment site, we have a track of when a user submitted the request for the IP allow or block list, and we go through that yearly. So every year, every year we go through the list, again, manually, and contact the requester, see if their IP is still needed to be in the allow or block list, and if so, get the new business justification and ensure it's there. If they find oh no, we're not doing business with that partner anymore, we'll actually remove the IP and remove them out of our request fulfillment forms.
Okay. And again, their mileage will vary, or their policies will vary depending on their business.
Absolutely. It's not something that you have to set up, the user request fulfillment forms. You can have your help desk do all this or not lifecycle manage any of this stuff, but we have we've done it in the past where we didn't have the lifecycle management on the IP allow list, and that list grows and grows and grows, and you have no idea why these IPs are on there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the review is a good idea.
Yes.
Okay. How large of a team does it take to manage the EOP service?
So to manage the EOP service at an engineering level, so deployment, configuration changes, we have a team of four engineers. One that acts as a service manager, and three actual admins. So the four of us will go through and make sure the service is configured correctly as new features become available in Office 365 and EOP. We'll evaluate at turning them on or off. So a team of four people manage our entire cloud infrastructure for email. So that's what we have.
Okay.
what's not included in that is, you know, help desk or our security team or any of those people or other teams. And I know our help desk team is a very large team.
Right.
So if you want to look at it all up, it's a big number. But in the actual configuration and management of EOP, it doesn't take that many.
And that of those four people that that do the engineering management, is that 100% of their time, or do they have other tasks and roles that they also do?
Yeah, they'll have other tasks and
okay.
roles, right?
So it's not 100% of their time is devoted to managing EOP.
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not. Yeah, so EOP isn't a set-it-and-forget-it tool.
But it requires periodic maintenance.
Periodic maintenance, and it doesn't take a long time to do that maintenance. We have a very laid-out plan when it comes to evaluating new features or turning things on or off, and we make sure that we follow the appropriate change control. And many, many enterprises out there have their own change control that you need to follow, and ultimately it's just going through that process.
Okay. Another question, what about advanced threat protection, ATP?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have statistics how functional it really is? That is it really worth the money, I guess, to pay for, or is EOP sufficient?
So ATP we do have on here in Microsoft IT with safe attachments as well as safe links. So safe attachments, I believe, is very much so worth the extra money. We utilize it. We have it turned on for everyone here at Microsoft. And it stops a lot of zero-day type attacks. Safe Links, however, was a little bit of a different bird, because the culture here at Microsoft was to hover over your link and take a look to make sure that was taking it to the right place.
Mm-hmm.
When we turned on safe attachments, when you hover over that link, the safe links, it shows the big long EOP link that it's directing you to, which caused some confusion here for our users. We still use safe links, and I believe it's worth the money, but not as much as the safe attachments bit.
Gotcha.
As for numbers, we definitely have. Did a business analysis on whether or not we should turn it on and leave it on. And so we found, again, your mileage may vary, but we found that it was beneficial for our organization. But you know, you're going to want to turn it on in a test mode for a smaller group of users first, just because it could be invasive if a user really does have a business need to send executable attachments to each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And it looks like the last question on the list of questions was, how much of the EOP processes that you mentioned do you have automated versus are done manually?
We have a lot that's done manually right now. And like I said, EOP isn't a set-it-and-forget-it service. But what we do have automated is the stuff for our help desk. We don't give our help desk rights to to alter a lot of these service level rules, just because, you know, one mistype can affect the entire company.
Mm-hmm.
So we've created some automation, basically a front end where they can go and add IPs to our allow and block lists, and then that gets added to a database on the back end, and then we, you know, every hour go update our IP allow list from the entries that they provided us. And that also tracks business justification as well as lifecycle management. So that'll also add them to the, you know, the 1 year. Let's go back and talk to the requester after that.
All right.
So if I had to give a number, I would probably say out of all the processes that we do, maybe 10% are automated. And it's all the stuff for our help desk.
Okay, excellent. All right, I think that just about wraps it up. Thank you, Shad.
Thanks,
and,
Jim.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Remember, we deliver these IT Showcase webinars frequently, and you can register for upcoming webinars and notifications for those webinars, and also find additional IT Showcase content at Microsoft.com/IT Showcase. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you.